Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances, we are joined by Ryan Hutchins, the managing partner of Peak Business Valuation, to talk about how to value a small business. Stick around. That's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Craftwork Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Craftwork Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always by my friend and co-host, Dan Maseka. And this week we've got a guest with us. Joining us from the West Coast, the managing partner of Peak Business Valuation, Ryan Hutchins. Thanks so much for being a part of it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We are excited to have you. Hope you're feeling better. We scrambled a couple weeks ago because we were so excited to talk with you at like to the point that we hadn't come up with another show idea. And then we were like, oh man, we got to talk about something. So we've been thinking about this for a few weeks, and valuation is such an interesting topic to the investing community. Your company, can we just get a high level overview? But I think you guys focus really on the private market, correct?
Correct. So we value around 25 to 30 companies a week for individuals buying and selling businesses all across the country. And it's like average business size ranges from 100,000 in revenue up to 10 million in revenue. So we're really small. And we're industry agnostic. So
these are like family businesses either looking for an appraisal because they need to set a benchmark of their worth, or maybe looking for a sale. Are those the kind of two spots where you end up running into people?
Yeah, those are our two kind of primary spots. We also do divorce and litigation work, ugly partner buyouts. So, and then gift and estate tax planning for business owners that are looking to kind of build a legacy. So
there are a lot of different ways to value a business. Can you tell us a little bit of the methods you use to come up with a valuation of a business that might be like a small player in a small market? And how would that, I don't know if you've done any investment analysis on public businesses, but how do those differ or compare?
Yeah, good question. So from a business valuation perspective, so business valuation related to small businesses correlates really well with larger corporations. The only difference is larger corporations have different operating centers and revenue centers. And so therefore, like, you almost value each of those separately because they will transact separately if kind of sold off. But from a small business perspective, like, business valuation comes down to three approaches. You could look at the assets. So understanding the fair market value of the underlying assets and intangible assets, and then subtract out liabilities. The second is called the market approach. And within the market approach, you have two different ways to assess. So you can look at private market transactions of similar companies from an operational as well as financial performance perspective. And you pull from it like revenue, EBITDA, seller's discretionary earnings multiples. Whereas in public markets, instead of looking at private transactions, you're just looking at the multiples of public companies. So it's very similar, but private transactions obviously don't have the glory and magnitude of being public. And so therefore, the multiples are much smaller for private companies, and there's a lot more risk inherent. And then the second or the third approach is called the income approach. Which here, if you're looking at a public company versus a private company, most public companies will build out what's called a discounted cash flow analysis, where you're projecting out future kind of income streams and discounting it back to today's present value. And we do something very similar, but on a smaller scale for a private company. And then there's a second methodology also called the capitalization of earnings or cash flow method, which essentially is more inherent for smaller businesses. Because if you have let's say a landscaping company that has been pretty much the same, just growing 5% per year, profitability is pretty much stable. Like, you can use this method, which just looks at historical cash flow and applies risk to it to arrive at a value. So that's valuation in a nutshell.
So when I look at small business entrepreneurs, I think it's funny that you mentioned kind of the cases in which you plug in, like the fact that you mentioned divorce. I would suspect that what I'm getting ready to ask is so different if there's a divorce involved, because when an entrepreneur starts a business, they're generally a big part of the operations, right? They're a big piece of that operating mechanism. And when you're thinking about, well, what's the business worth? It's really, what's it worth if I have to then hire for their role or replace their role? Yep. And so I suspect that there's a big difference in how you value the company with them working in it, where part of what they view as the business profit is really their fair compensation, right? For the role of being CEO, I should get paid X, and I'm doing that job, plus I'm managing all this other like crap that's going on during a day. How do you separate that from what the business is worth without them in it? And how much do they argue that difference when it's a divorce versus a sale?
Yeah, so from a sale, you almost look at it from the perspective of, oh, the potential buyer can easily step into my shoes. Like you're painting the business in a slightly different light. Whereas in divorce, when you have a prominent party involved that thinks they are the business, it really comes down to states. So states have different kind of ways to treat divorce, and more importantly, the term personal goodwill. So Florida recognizes personal goodwill, but other states don't. And so from a business valuation standpoint, you can't extract the personal goodwill value. Instead, you look at it from the standpoint of like, what would I have to fairly compensate someone to do this same position? And if I have to hire multiple people to do this same position, what would that be? In cases where you're recognizing and looking at personal goodwill, like you could do what's called a with or without scenario. Like, what is the kind of income streams produced by the company based on so-and-so in the business versus not in the business? So good example, we worked with someone kind of in the Mountain West who their hourly rate versus their employees were at around $100 an hour. They were at $500 an hour. And it was because they were working with athletes. And so therefore, like the revenue of the company was significantly higher because of the work that he was doing. And so in that whole divorce case was all about how if he were not in the business, revenue would probably be closer to $100 an hour based on the employees. So that was a fun one. Typically most divorces settle instead of go to trial. So that one we were hoping would settle instead of go to trial, because that's like, it's always fun to be cross-examined and answer questions about personal goodwill, because it's more so subjective than objective.
Yeah, I think you touched on one thing that's both interesting and very frustrating with valuation. It in our business and financial planning too, I often say that there's not one right answer. It's an art where there's a range of possible answers, and business valuation is very much similar. There is not one true value of a business, public or private, I guess, except at what someone's willing to pay for it. But you have to kind of interpret information to arrive at your best guess. And I'd imagine that you can get objections from the other party if you deliver them a value with your estimate. Has that ever gotten contentious where you present them with your valuation and they say, that's garbage, like try again?
Oh yeah, it happens on a weekly basis. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, what are people hiring us for? They're hiring us for our knowledge, education, and opinion, and kind of following kind of set guidelines by different valuation boards that say, this is how you do it. And ultimately, like the standard of value that we typically conclude to is what's called fair market value. So what is a hypothetical buyer, hypothetical seller willing to transact at? And at the end of the day, like the only true value is what is someone willing to buy it at and what are they willing to sell it at? So like you think of homes, like homes have their asking price, but they always transact at something different than their asking price. So it's a tricky game. But when you're valuing 25 to 30 companies a week, Like it enables you to kind of like just do so many more reps than other firms that are doing like 30 to 40 per year. And so the our graphs on the market is vastly different than other valuation firms just due to volume.
So I'm curious about this because it sounds like you guys are busy. You're transacting or part of a lot of transactions. How often do you get a second data point? Because the thing about valuing a business, like if I look at a stock today and I say, I think it's overpriced or I think it's underpriced, I think it's a great deal, I can watch what the market tells me it's going to do over the next year, 3 years, 5 years, mm-hmm. and understand, it's not even was I right, it's did the market agree with me, right? Did it come back yeah. towards the value? I don't get to figure out whether I was correct, but I do get to figure out whether or not the market ultimately recognized the value that I thought was present or not present by just watching the stock price. I can see what the market's going to tell me it does. How often do you get any validation of those prices that you come up with?
Oh, great question. So 3 days ago, we delivered three separate business valuation reports for different franchise locations. And the individual that hired us and engaged us was the owner and looking to sell each of those three locations. And when we presented the values to her, she's like, you guys want to know something crazy? And we're like, oh, yeah. You came in $1,000 below what my buyer was asking. And I'm like, oh, that's pretty sweet. Like, and those instances are very far. Like, they don't really happen as often. Typically, like, margin of error, 5 to 10% is what's normal. We did a business valuation. They're kind of selling equity to an individual, and they ordered two separate business valuation reports. So our value came in at less than the other one at a material like number. And essentially the clients will be like, hey, can you look at the other valuation report? And we have someone on our team that has been reviewing valuation reports of others for 25 years, primarily for litigation purposes. And so to him, it's fun and games to basically show like why there's differences, where they're wrong, or if they're right, we need to change our analysis. So yeah, does that answer that question, Ross?
Yeah, I think a little bit. You know, it's just, I guess from over time, from point to point, that's, I guess, the curiosity is like, do you get a second look at the same company again? Do you ever get a chance to look at it 5 years down the road and get to look at a past valuation and go, yep, we nailed it, or like, whoops, missed something there. And obviously the landscape changes, but I'm just curious how, if you get a chance to validate what a prior opinion translates to in the open market.
Yeah. So like we work with clients on an annual basis to help them understand and kind of show kind of how the company is pacing. Really what's fun, so about half the work that we do is we're engaged by banks to perform business valuations, and we will do business valuations that of a company that we valued 3 years ago, and they're either using their same bank or they've engaged a bank for the loan that uses us for the valuation. And in those cases, it's always fun to see kind of how the company has fared over that time period between when we first did the valuation and then this other valuation. And really what's hard, like any public company, the metrics and the operations and the people running the show like truly matters. In small businesses, it matters even more.
It matters a lot.
Yeah, because like we've worked with buyers that have taken over companies, and within 6 months, they're declaring bankruptcy. And it's because they were the wrong operators for the business. Whereas we also work with individuals that buy businesses, and then 3 weeks later, the seller, after the close of the transaction, is like, hey, by the way, revenue is going to fall off a cliff because we service these machines and they stopped producing those machines 5 years ago. Those situations are fun where we'll value the business again based on that new information. And the value is so dramatically different that they then sue the seller for wrongful kind of representation. So,
I mean, me and Dan had a situation that we talked about. Dan, I hope you don't mind me sharing this. Like, you were looking at buying a bagel shop, I think, at one point. And the question, and then it was like, well, how old is the equipment, right? Because you didn't want to have to buy a bagel shop and then immediately flip around and replace mm-hmm. every single thing in it. You might as well just start fresh if you're going to have to buy all the stuff that it wasn't. They were like at the end of their lease, so the lease was going to have to be renegotiated. Like, all the things that you could look at in the operating mechanics of that business were essentially invalidated because they were going to have to change. And it was like, yeah, you're starting over. So it doesn't matter how profitable they've been. If they basically squeezed all the life out of the machinery and then you come in, it's like, who cares what they did last year?
Yeah. Machinery is so key. Like, we're working with a business right now. The individual is looking to buy the company, but he has to, like, there's a particular machine in that operation that if he were to replace it today, it would cost $500,000. And you're like, that is huge. But come to find out, the current machine in operation, the manufacturer stopped manufacturing it 2 years ago. And so the parts, spare parts, are first come, first serve. And it's like, if that machine is not operating and generating revenue, then he's just losing. So he's like, if I buy this business, like, should I just buy a new machine outright that I could get serviced instead of waiting during a down period? Because I have to wait for parts. So it's, yeah, machinery is a very difficult thing to factor into the value of a company.
Dan, what were you going to say?
I was going to say two things. First, I think your story is emblematic of how far I would go for a good bagel, to the point where I would buy a bagel shop in order to make that happen, which remains true. I just, the timing hasn't come yet.
Yeah, Severn needs to get on its bagel game.
That's true. Hardcore. Also, I think it speaks to the different methodologies of valuation that Ryan was talking about earlier, because, you know, if we're looking at asset sales versus income approaches and all those different things, like, that needs to inform the price of a business. And mm-hmm. if you're so dependent on the assets or they're, you know, the business is not valuable if those aren't functioning, you know, maybe you lean more towards one versus the other in terms of finding your weighted average. There's a, I'm in the brewery space. The way I met Ryan is he did a valuation on a brewery I'm a partner for, which every listener is probably well aware of at this point.
Unless it's your first episode.
Unless it's your first brewery. Episode. And there have been a lot of transactions in the brewery space locally, but there's one that was listed recently explicitly as an asset sale. I think because if you were to look at the income of the location, it just wouldn't stand up to being mm-hmm. sold at like any sort of reasonable number. So they're like, here, just buy this equipment from us, basically. You can have that and start over. Forget about the actual business. We have a brewing facility available for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brewing is probably one of the most fascinating ones, because ultimately, so we value close to 2 breweries a month. And of those, I would say 90% are hobbies and not businesses, because they're losing $50,000 to $200,000 a year. And it's like, oh, we brought on this new investor. And it's like, why? You should just liquidate and sell. Like, you can't operate. You're spending money from this activity to fund this fun hobby of yours.
Yeah, that's not exciting. That is certainly not a way to start a business.
It's not exciting unless you wanted a hobby, right? There's a lot of businesses that I think end up in that category, right? There's the joke about starting a winery that the way you make a small fortune in wine is to start with a big fortune, right? Like, there's things that people get super passionate about and they decide, this is my thing. I'm going to be in this business because of my passion. And it turns out they don't have a clue how to run the business, and it's a steep learning curve. So, I think that's probably what's happening in those things where people get really excited about the product, and beer is certainly in that category.
So Ryan, because you have so many reps on valuing businesses and you see so many potential transactions coming through, are there any trends you're noticing in the small business space over the last year or two? Anything that you're seeing more now than what you were seeing 5 years ago?
Yeah, well, COVID changed quite a bit. One of the like primary deal killers in transactions over the last year has been a result of landlords. So as because of COVID, a lot of landlords, when they were renewing their lease agreement with the lessee, they kind of put a clause in that they basically have a first right of refusal of the individual who would buy that business. And so like it has made transactions more difficult. So like understanding leases and having a lease attorney kind of early on is key.
Can we unpack that? I just want to make sure we're clear about what you just said and that doesn't go over people's heads. So in order to sell my business that I'm a private owner in, I run whatever shop I run, bagel shop, whatever it is. I make a contract with this strip mall that's going to hold my bagel shop. And I say, I'm going to give you X dollars per month for the next 10 years to stick my shop here. And they're putting a line in that that says, if you sell your bagel shop, we get to approve who you sell it to. And if they don't pass our test, you don't get to sell your business.
Yep. It's a very dirty clause. And most individuals, like they we're all used to it, like iTunes or any kind of software provider that we have a subscription with is like, here, read our terms and conditions. And you're like, no. And you just check the box. But like in lease agreements, most small business owners that enter into a lease agreement don't really know the underlying terms. That's and so, hiring a lease attorney is pivotal when buying a business. One of the other areas that kind of like most people don't read lease agreements, most people don't understand the financials, even if they own the company. And so like if we're working with someone who is buying a business and they do their books, or the company that they're buying does their books every December. And so they don't know what the company is doing except by looking at the bank accounts on a monthly basis. And it's like we provide a service called a quality of earnings or proof of cash. And it's like there are so many discrepancies in how they're like pulling money in and out of that bank account. And it's because they're doing everything in 1 month and trying to recall what happened 11 months prior. So that's probably one of the, outside of leases, that is one of the most kind of scrutinized areas, is a clear picture of the financial operations of the business. Because most people couldn't even tell you what their actual profitability is. And yeah.
I had a client who hired me in part to help them evaluate the process of purchasing a business and just making sure that they were thinking it through clearly and that their personal financial situation was conducive to it. And they brought me to a convenience store that they knew someone was selling, and they wanted me to walk through it and see it. And then I'm like, all right, well and good. Like, do we have any reporting? And the people brought out those, like, you know, those black and white notepads with just daily handwritten financials for years, just in paper, handwritten form. I'm like, I don't know that I can do anything with this. Like, this is crazy.
At least they've got some records. I bet there's places where that's even not even possible. You're like, well, nope, not even handwritten. We didn't have any of those.
Well, like one of the more infamous business models where there are no records for some of the revenue, you got liquor stores, and then you got kind of nail salons. Like any business that will take cash receipts, those cash receipts, you can't track them. Like they don't report them on a tax return, so therefore they're evading taxes. And so, but when it comes to transaction time, they're like, oh, those cash receipts should be included. And it's like, well, you've already eaten your cake by not paying the government. Like a bank's not going to lend on it because they don't want to get caught in the crossfires. So it's financials are very interesting in understanding kind of the paper trail, not in your case, Daniel, with an actual paper trail. But like digital paper trail, it's always important.
So I guess I've got two different directions I could go with this. But when there's kind of this narrative that you've got a lot of businesses owned by baby boomers that are ultimately looking to retire, right? So you've got a lot of closely held businesses that are likely to transition in the next handful of years to next 20 years, whether that means to second generation, whether that means to outside sellers. So I think in your world, first of all, you're probably in a good spot because I think there's going to be a lot of this happening that people need to come up with values for this. Mm-hmm. Are there pockets where you're seeing opportunity? Like if we went on to biz buy sell or, you know, whatever marketplace, we can go find a bunch of small businesses. Are there some that you think are being really undervalued, or is there a spot that if I were a shopper and saying, I want to be a buyer of a business, who's not getting recognized for what the business is actually worth or how powerful it could be as a cash flow generator?
Good question. So just based on experience and what I see, like that, my knowledge is limited to that. So one of the areas that is most attractive right now to people just because of mispricing their business is anything within the contracting space. And so there's more people that own businesses that because they think they are the business, they have their shingle, and then one day they pull down their shingle and say, I'm no longer in business. And most of those contractors, they're not business professionals. They just are good at a trade and are trying to maximize kind of their profit potential and earning potential, and they just hire people. So like that's the area that I like to play in with a couple individuals that I'm partners with. We like buying contracting businesses because there's more opportunity to find an underpriced business, as well as like there are some owners that we've targeted where we're like, we love your business. We know you don't understand what you should be transacting at. And so we'll kind of meet you in the middle and give you more than what you're expecting. And it's like, that's the contracting, anything like plumbing, HVAC, electrical, glazing, concrete, landscaping. Like that's probably where like you have businesses priced right, but most are priced wrong.
Interesting. Do you see some of that wave coming? Like, do you feel like the volume is increasing or the number of these transactions? I mean, it sounds like you're doing a bunch of these valuations, but where are you versus where you were maybe 5 years ago? And is that because there's more businesses coming to market, or is that just a function of where your current business flow has been?
I would say it's more of a function of how I've structured my company with my partner. The way we've structured it is more from an educational standpoint. And so we have our website, peakbusinessvaluation.com. We help educate individuals on how to assess the value and understand the value drivers behind value for any industry, just to give people some basic understanding. So our business model is vastly different because we get about 10,000 people a week to our website. And the average valuation firm probably gets around 200 people a week. So like from that, like the silver wave that people like coin and chat about of all these baby boomers selling their companies, like all you have to do is look at from an SBA or a conventional lending perspective, like the volume hasn't changed drastically as what like I think the stats, there's 10,000 baby boomers retiring a day. And it's like, okay, if those people are retiring a day, 3% of the population owns a business. That means 300 people should be selling businesses. But we all know that of those 300 people a day that should be selling a business, probably less than 10% actually do. Because you look at biz buy stats or bizbuysell.com, and they have thousands of business listed, but only like 20% actually transact. So a lot of people own businesses that are really just not, they're more owner operator. And so it's like, why would I buy your business where I'm going to make $100,000 max when I could have a W-2 job that I could potentially make $100,000 at, and I don't have stress and I have more time off and flexibility. So it's a very interesting trade-off. So we haven't seen a wave yet, but I'm always hopeful it's going to come in the near future. That's why I stay in the business I'm in.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a good job with it, and you're busy. Yeah, it's funny. Being in DC, the Washington Nationals and the Lerner family that owns it are in the news quite a bit. And at one point they were trying to name the stadium and they didn't get the price that they wanted. And so they just left Nationals Park on the stadium. Rather than take like a couple million less than what they thought it was worth, they were just like, nah, like literally go away. We would rather have $0 than undervalue this. And they just did that again with selling the team. Like they were trying to shop the team. They were kind of like, yeah, we're done with this. So I think we're going to be out. They didn't get the valuation they wanted. And they were like, fine, we'll just run it. And like, I wonder how often that's happening in the small business world where people are either, be nice, but like delusional about what the value of their thing is. I've been making X for this many years. It's worth $5 million. They don't get their number. And they're like, whatever, I'm just going to stay in. And like, I would bet you see that a lot, honestly.
Oh, it happens all the time. So one instance, we valued a beauty salon. We delivered the valuation report last week. We had a discussion with the prospective buyer. And the prospective buyer was like, hey, the seller doesn't want to sell. And it's like, well, let's chat about why. And it's like, you came in like 4 times less than what she was wanting to transact at. And it's like, well, if you look at the historical financials and the story being told, the year, which was 2 years ago when the seller stopped actively operating in the business, the profitability of the company dropped 90%. And it's like, obviously, you're not going to be able to transact the business at the same price. And they're like, well, it's an absentee business. And it's like, no one wants to buy an absentee business where the individuals running the ship, which are now the employees, can't even understand why they shouldn't be buying X for $5 and they buy it for 20. Like, it's all expense management and you're hiring extra people to do what you were doing. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of disconnect with individuals. There, one business in particular that their CPA valued the business at $10 million. We came in at 1.5. And we keep asking like, hey, can we set up a conversation and discuss and understand like why can you produce how that CPA arrived at that $10 million? And she's like, I don't think we could do that. And it's like, so it's a number out of thin air.
I mean, that's how most of us think about it. I know we're running a little bit long in terms of your time, so we appreciate you being generous with us. The thing about a market valuation or a market linked valuation, when you're going to compare your transaction to other transactions, in so many cases, you're comparing against what might have otherwise been a crazy transaction. Right. Like ultimately you have to not only say what did they buy and what did they buy it for, but is there some secondary layer of like, and we think they're nuts, right? Because like we can look at a stock market valuation and say historically S&P 500 trades at 15, 16, 17 times earnings. Mm-hmm. Right now it's trading at a 4 or earnings multiple of 20. So we're paying more by stocks today than we were historically. Is that sort of inflated valuation or saying, hey, the market is kind of a little hot, does that get baked back into this and say, yep, this is kind of what a landscaping company is selling for, but people are paying more for them today than they were 5 years ago?
Yeah. So a couple industry, like there, it's that question relates to more industry specific. So for instance, like financial planning, individuals that are selling 90% plus recurring revenue books of businesses to others. Like there's almost 20 buyers for every seller. And so in that case, like the revenue multiples that we've seen over the last year have all ranged between 2 to 3x revenue on a book of business. Whereas if we look at kind of trends 5 years ago, it was closer to 1.5 to 2x. Another kind of fun industry that has kind of been on a roller coaster is FedEx routes. So in the craze of FedEx routes in 2021 and 2022, we were valuing about 1 to 2 a week. And we saw multiples as high as 4.5 to 5 times EBITDA. And today, those multiples are closer to like 3.5 to 4. And the reason being is every company has variable input cost. And as the input costs change, primarily like FedEx, you got labor and then fuel expenditure. As those costs change, like the profitability decreases, and the likelihood of that being a absentee business model has kind of disappeared just because people now have options and are now voicing them more. And so people don't show up to work anymore. So,
you're comparing against publicly UPS offering drivers $160,000+ a year, right? Like you've got very headline news that's going to push on your labor cost if you're running a FedEx route.
Yeah. And it's like businesses will kind of going back to what Daniel said at the beginning, like the value of a business is what two people are willing to transact at. And ultimately, like there's a lot of perceived value, like that people are baking in because of the cross-selling capabilities. So now they're bringing synergies into the picture. And because there's synergies, like obviously the business should be worth more. So its investment value is much higher. So yeah, like compared to the stock market, and I would say a lot of businesses just based on the current capital markets of what you could get debt at to buy a business, a lot of those businesses are more overpriced just based on kind of like I bought a plumbing business in 2021 at a 6.5% interest rate. Now we're at 11.25%. So we pay an extra $50,000 a year in interest. Whereas instead of having another technician, we're just paying the bank. So like there's businesses are higher, but it's kind of like if you look at the housing market, it all comes down to supply and demand and what the economics say. So like there's a lot more individuals that are interested in buying businesses now just because you have influencers like Alex Ramosi, Cody Sanchez, just different people on TikTok and Instagram and LinkedIn that are just promoting, hey, you should buy a business. So the big term right now that's being thrown around is called ETA, entrepreneurship through acquisition. And there's groups popping up on every college campus across the country. And it is becoming a more viable option to buy a business coming out of undergrad or graduate school than kind of going and working for a prestigious company. So because you have more buyers coming to the table and there's fewer good options for them to like acquire the company, like you just have more people bidding. And so brokers love it because they can make a higher commission. So it's a very fascinating space to be in right now.
Man, I could listen to this all day. You could literally run through multiple changes over like a 5-year period. I'd be captivated for
an hour. I love that you brought up our business because financial planning and wealth management, like I've been aware of those transaction multiples and we see the listings all the time. So there are a couple mm-hmm. services that deal with financial advisors that are looking to sell a practice. Succession Link and FP Transitions. Like there's a few of those and we get emails from them all the time. And it's like, this is what we're doing in revenue. This is what we're asking or negotiable or whatever. And you can see people are normally starting now at 2.5x revenue, where I think 2 used to be like the high standard when I got into the world. And that like we decided to build it instead. Like that's like, cause you deal with so much stuff. You're going to pay the next 2.5 years worth of what you're going to make up front. Now, granted, you can finance it, but fine. And then you've got all this risk of actually operating their business of did all those clients just love that guy, right? Like they are, or girl, right? Like whoever the planner was in that seat, whoever the advisor was, all of their clients might hate me. They might all like there's not a single guarantee that a client stays because clients are not locked to an advisor. So you're going to pay potentially lots of money and then you've got this single point of failure. Now, if you're buying a more established kind of multi-person shop and you're keeping all the advisors on staff, I'm sure it all changes, but we literally were like, yeah, I think we're just going to start from zero rather than taking on that risk and buying somebody's thing with the illusion that we're going to make a bunch of money that's already just operating. But it, you know, so that was our path. We couldn't make it work in our brains, at least.
No, it's a smart path to just build, because ultimately you figure out what makes you unique. So, for instance, you guys have a podcast. Most financial planners don't. So
we like our podcast.
there are at least some out there who agree with us.
Yeah, there are tens of people listening. No. Naturally, we do appreciate the podcast audience. This has been so much fun to be a part of this. And Ryan, I think that's probably a good place to leave it for today. We appreciate you as well. This is like Dan, I could listen to this all day. I love talking about where businesses are, what are the mechanics, what are the risks, because I think it's how my brain works, is to try and assess some of that. I certainly don't have the fidelity on it that you do, because of how many you see and how many different industries, but I find it really, really cool. So thank you for giving us some of your time to share that with our audience.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Ross and Daniel.
So for those looking for Ryan, he did mention the URL, but it's peakbusinessvaluation.com is where you can find him. A lot of great stuff on their website. Or if you're looking to sell your business or buy one, he's a good person to be in touch with. If you've got questions for Dan and I, check your balances at outlook.com is the email address for the show. We've got a mailbag episode coming up. We appreciate you all tuning in. We'll catch you next week.